Alrighty. So let me expand. I'll just go right to my source sheet. And here we are. Okay. Title is Who is the Achashverosh of the Megillah? Okay. Megillah is there. And give a little more room over here. And I'll try to go in order today. First thing I want to do, before we talk about who's Achashverosh of the Megillah, just a question about the composition of Megillat Esther. And I think we talked about this in general way back, but whenever you read a book in Tanakh, you always have to ask yourself the question, what was the author's intent? So if it's talking about Chumash, God's the author, telling Moshe what to write pretty much. But the question is not whether God wrote or not, the question, why is God giving us this book? The book is from God. Is God making up a story sometimes to teach you something, or is he telling you history? Or why is he telling you this story and skipping that story? How come he contradicts himself? But the assumption is that whoever the author of the book is coming to teach you something and giving you a message. Nevi'im, there's a reason why Sefer Yeshua is written, not just to teach you history, it has a prophetic point. The same thing with Sefer Shoftim. So that's it, no matter what book you're studying, that's always the first question you have to ask. How to get the answer, that's not so simple. Now, I just want to give two examples of books where the author's intent is critical in understanding what's happening. So Shir HaShirim, I want to begin with that because it's similar to Megillat Esther, because there's the big question whether or not it belongs in Tanakh. In other words, most books in Tanakh, in general, have to do with the relationship between God and the people of Israel. That's pretty much what Tanakh is about. You know, God chooses a nation to serve him forever. The definition of that relationship is in Chumash. The Nevi'im would try to put it in the right direction. We're going to be in Nevi'im. And the history of what they did wrong, what they did right, and seeing the hand of God behind history is Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim. And then we have Tehillim, how we talk to God or pray to God, Mishlei, and things like that. But when you get to Shir HaShirim, you could easily read it as a love story. And what does that have to do with our relationship with God? So if I follow the way Chazal understand the book of Shir HaShirim, their understanding is, even though it's a love story, the love story was written in order to explain the connection between God and his people. And because it's hard to understand the relationship between God and the people, but in light of what we read in Parshat Shavua, in Parshat Yitro, and Neder Mishpatim, where Am Yisrael enters a covenant with God, and the prophets later compare that covenant between God and his people, or the event at Har Sinai to a type of a wedding, and it's a husband-wife type of relationship, then Shir HaShirim is taking that idea a step farther and talking about a love story, and that love story is going to represent or reflect the complexity of the relationship between God and his people and possibly redemption. Now, someone could disagree with that and say, no, it's just a love story, and the rabbis put that on. But the way the rabbis understand the book is that the book was written in order to teach that message of a relationship between God and his people, but it's using a love story to get the point across. And then you have to study the book. At first, at the pshat level, what's happening, and then look behind the book to see what the deeper meaning is. Just one, Divrei Yamim, we talked about, but when we talk about Divrei Yamim, which sounds like the Book of Chronicles, we explained in our earlier classes that Divrei Yamim wasn't written just to tell you what happened, but it's a book written in the beginning of the Second Temple period to explain to the people who are returning in the Second Temple period how to relate to Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash based on examples, especially from King David from the First Temple period. And I have to take that in consideration when I understand what's in the book and what's not in the book and the differences between Divrei Yamim and Malachim. And then we saw Ezra Nehemiah was a continuation of Divrei Yamim. We did that in our early classes. Now that takes us to Megillat Esther. When I studied Megillat Esther, the question is, what was the story in the book? Is it true or not? The question is, what's the purpose of its composition? Who composed it, when it was composed, and why it wasn't composed? And I could read the book and not know a thing about God for a very simple reason, because the book doesn't mention God's name. On the other hand, it's canonized. If it's canonized by the rabbis, that means the rabbis understand that God is in the book, even though he's not mentioned. So I just want to repeat, because that's our key point, that's our point of departure. Assuming that Chazal have a good reason for canonizing Megillat Esther, their understanding is, someone could say maybe they're wrong, but there's no doubt that the rabbis understand that whoever wrote Megillat Esther, be it Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, or Mordechai and Esther themselves, possibly, whoever wrote the book was trying to convey a message about our relationship with God. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in Tanakh. But if that's the purpose of the book, why is God not mentioned? So therefore, when we ask who composed the book and why, it makes sense to assume that God's, it relates to God's relationship with his people, but why isn't God mentioned? So I want to bring before we get to the time period, we got to let this there. I want to give an analogy from Parshat Shavua. Let me stop the screen share for a minute. I'm not sure if we ever did this year, but when you study, if you might remember studying the story of Mamad Har Sinai, you might remember that God's first plan was to speak through Moshe to the people. In other words, God wanted to deliver the Ten Commandments, speaking to Moshe inside of a cloud, and the people would overhear, and Moshe would tell the people what God said. And then, if you study the story carefully, it seems like the people actually wanted to hear directly from God. Now, chapter 19 doesn't say that explicitly, but when you study it carefully, you can reach that conclusion. So then the question comes up, if that indeed was the case, for example, like what Chazal tell us, that the first two commandments we heard directly from God, and then we got scared, and we heard the last eight through Moshe. If that's true, why isn't that explicit in the text? So one approach is, it's in the text, but only alluded to in the text, because what's called the message is the medium. By writing a text in a way that obfuscates, that purposely hides Am Yisrael's request to hear God directly. And the only way you can determine that is by studying the text carefully, by studying first person, third person, like just analyzing the text carefully. Then what the message might be is that the only way you'll realize that the people wanted a direct connection to God, if you search for it in the text. And that itself might relate to the purpose of the text. As the purpose is, the text is purposely obfuscating or hiding the people's request to be so close to God. And the only way you can find that request to be so close to God is if you look carefully in the text. Or basically, what you need to do to the text is what you need to do to find God. If you don't search for God, you won't find him. And I want to take that idea, which I think is more obvious now when we let this there. Meaning, if the purpose of the book is to find God behind the events, then say so. Everywhere else in Tanakh, it's explicit. You know, God said that the reason why Nebuchadnezzar took over Jerusalem, Yirmiyahu says, God brought him in. The reason why Koresh allowed the Jews to return, that was God. All through Tanakh, the Nevi'im are saying, the reason for this punishment is because you disobeyed God. But God is behind the punishment. He's behind reward. But God's behind everything. And it's explicit. If I have one book where it's not explicit, then it could be that God wants the author of the book wants the reader to reach that conclusion on his own through study of the text or study of the events and find God through a careful study, which might reflect the message of the book, which is, if God is in the book, but he's hidden, I might allude to that by calling the key character hidden or Esther, because her real name I think was Hadassah. And just like what God wanted Am Yisrael to do, at least in exile, is to see the hand of God behind events, then basically the way the Megillah is written, by hiding God's name on purpose, where it should be obvious that God's there, so by hiding God's name and causing the reader to find God behind the story, that's exactly what God wants us to do always throughout history, is even though we don't see God right in front of us, we have to look for God behind all the historical events. The question is, what's God's message? That's a different question. But finding God, even though you don't see him, that might be the key to understanding not just our relationship with God in general, but especially in exile when the Shekhinah is not there. So that's just my point number one, where the fact that God's name isn't mentioned might not just be a technicality, it might be the underlying message of the book. Now, if you remember all the earlier shiurim about the Cyrus Declaration, and is this the beginning of our redemption? Remember all the reasons why people didn't make Aliyah? Which obviously we're going to relate to Megillat Esther. We've been waiting for this since the beginning we started the classes. But it's the same idea when you're living in Persia, and all of a sudden there's this declaration by the new emperor, like the first Persian king, Cyrus, defeats the Babylonians and allows the Jews to return to their land and does it in the name of this god named Marduk, but allows the Jews to return and build a temple. Is that simply a political move by a Persian king, or is God behind those events? And of course, the book of Ezra, and we'll see later in what we call Deuteronomy, was saying that explicitly. Now, assuming the book is religious and you're supposed to find God in the book, the question comes up, who is the king who's Ahasuerus in the Megillah? So now let's go back to our source sheet and we'll get to work. What do we do? Okay, we listen, and the time period we do the time, we're gonna find the time period we got based on sources in the Bible and historical sources, and we'll try to understand not just the time period of the Megillah, but the prophetic purpose in Megillat Esther in light of the books of Haggai and Zechariah that we've been studying for the last several weeks. Okay, so let's begin with our first source. The first source we've seen many times, the first chapter of Ezra. Just skip to it real fast. It's at the bottom. I put all the sources at the bottom. There we are. We got a lot of work to do today. Everyone remembers the first chapter of Ezra? The first year of Koresh, the king of Paras, as Yirmiyahu had promised. God inspired Koresh, and you know he gave this famous decree to allow the Jews to return. God gave me all the kingdoms of the land, and he wants me to build a house for God in Jerusalem, and anyone in the Jewish nation can go back and build a house for God, etc. Now, just one point I want to highlight here in verse 5 in Pasuk Hey, not everyone made Aliyah, but some people did. The Akumu Rashi Avot Yehuda Binyamin V'Kohanim V'Levim. Some leaders of Yudan Binyamin who were in exile got up and answered the call. Anyone who was inspired by God to go and build God's house in Yerushalayim. And other people sent presents. Now, key to understanding a famous Midrash. Remember, Koresh is the first Persian king, and we know Ahasuerus is a Persian king. So I hope that's perfectly clear, that if Koresh is the first Persian king and Ahasuerus is a Persian king, then Koresh precedes Ahasuerus, and the story of Megillat Esther happens after this event. But listen carefully. V'melech Koresh hotzid klei Beit Hashem. King Koresh took out the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, asher hotzi Nebuchadnezzar Mirushalayim. See the word hotzi and hotzi? Koresh took out the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash that Nebuchadnezzar took out of the Mikdash in Yerushalayim, and Nebuchadnezzar had put the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash in his God's domain, temple. V'yotziim, Koresh took those out. Koresh took them out with the help of Mitridas, is the treasure. V'yisparim l'sheish batzar nesid l'Yehuda. And he gave them to the king of the, to the prince of the Jews. In other words, Koresh took the kelim, the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, and gave them to the Jews to bring back, to use them to build the Beit HaMikdash. Now, Bhatia raised, okay, I'll stop my share. What's your question, Bhatia? I'm hoping you're asking a question I wanted to hear.
It may not be, but there's no chat suddenly. I see the name.
Wait, let me check. Go I see ahead. A chat. Okay, the source is.
Chat's
I,
there.
I can't, I wasn't able to share the source. The source will be on the website soon.
Okay. Okay. I see the name Koresh in Ahasuerus.
Where in where?
In the letters and the sounds.
Oh, Koresh in Ahasuerus.
Ve-Rosh. The Kav, the Resh, and the Shin, Koresh, Ahasuerus. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask something else. I'll go back to your question. But first, I'll answer your question briefly. In a nutshell, the names of the Persian kings in Persia did not sound like their pronunciation in Hebrew or in English. In other words, for example, Xerxes, and is, I think in Persian it's, or Greek, was called Xerxes or something like that. So when you take a name in one language and translate it to a different language, it's always going to sound a little bit different. My favorite example, anyone who's been to Yerushalayim near the King David Hotel, there's a street called Rehov Lincoln. Probably you've seen it before, named after Abe Lincoln. But in Hebrew, when you spell Lincoln in Hebrew, it comes out to Lincoln. So it's called Lincoln. And if your name is Schwartz in English, when you make Aliyah, it's Schwartz. And the second you move a name to a different language, it sounds a little bit different. So therefore, we'll have to be matching up the names, but we're going to go in that direction. Now, I want to go back to the question I wanted to hear. What famous Midrash do you remember from Megillat Esther about the kidding of the Beit HaMikdash? Yeah, Susan? Oh, no, who raised
that? That the Kelim, Mikelim, Shonim in the first chapter are the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash.
Yeah, So I'm sure everyone learned that early in their childhood, almost when they heard Nasa V'Nishma was before Matan Torah. It's something you learn probably before. But it's one of the basic things that what happened when we were at the party of Achashverosh, and the Megillah describes there's all these beautiful vessels at the party. Where are the vessels from? They're vessels from the Beit HaMikdash. Now, it could be that the rabbis who said that simply never read the book of Ezra, got it? Which is hard to believe. Or it could be they studied the book of Ezra and are assuming that the audience, the readership, knows the book of Ezra, and they want the audience to put two and two together. Right? When you make a statement which is obviously not true, then why are they saying that? Then they're sort of alluding to the fact that there's some connection between the Kelim and the Beit HaMikdash and this story in Ezra and Megillat Esther. Hope that point's clear. Just want to make it one more time. We're going to find a we're going to find a famous midrash, a commentary on Megillat Esther, trying to understand why were the Jews almost punished in that time period. And they say because they used the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, which would be a sin, what's called Bi'ilah. That means you're not allowed to use things that belong to the temple sanctuary, or they enjoyed that, you know, using those vessels. The problem is the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash were already returned to Jerusalem. So some commentators say only some of them returned and some remained. But it didn't say that in the book of Ezra. It could be the Medrash wants the reader to pay attention to the that maybe the author's original intent of mentioning the words Kelim was to want the reader to connect the Megillah to that story in the book of Ezra. And that's where we have to follow, is the that's my big question, which I want to prove now over the next this week and next week. Is the author of Megillat Esther assuming that his audience is aware of the books of Ezra, Haggai, and Zechariah, and Jewish history, and the Torah? Am I supposed to read Megillat Esther as a standalone book? Or am I assuming my readers, my audience, is aware of the books of Tanakh, especially of that time period? And the only way you get the message of the book if you know the time period. I'll give you a much better example. I'm sure everyone's read Animal Farm. In high school, and I think 11th grade, we had to read Animal Farm. I remember reading, I had to do a book report. I had no idea, never heard of the Russian Revolution in my life. No, I went to a yeshiva high school, whoever studied Russian Revolution and Bolsheviks. And it wasn't that about 20 years old that I realized one day that Animal Farm was written as a commentary on the Russian Revolution, which means I could read the whole book of Animal Farm, Lahavdil Alef Havdalot, and see it as a really good book, really appreciate it, and not have any knowledge of what the author's intent was. Because the author's intent was not just to write a nice book, but the author's intent was to make a commentary on the Russian Revolution, if I understand George Orwell correctly. Now, which means I could write a book which would be understood by an audience, but the author's intent could be misunderstood if they don't know the background. And that's what I want to share with you. I want to take that analogy, and I'm asking myself, is the reader... go back a step. If I know the Russian Revolution and I read Animal Farm, I'll start putting two and two together. And I'll start laughing and smiling and snickering in different parts, and everything will be really interesting. But if I'm not aware, it'll go right over my head. So the same thing, what I have to show you, why find enough circumstantial evidence in the book of Esther to show that the author wants the reader to connect the events of Megillat Esther to Psukim and Chumash, to the story in the book of Ezra, to the vote of Haggai and Zechariah, etc. And that's what we're going to try and prove over the next 2 weeks. But the first thing we need to do is find the timeline and find where is Achashverosh in the timeline. So let's take a look again at our source sheet. Where are we? Here we are. Now, it's just before, as long as we're down here, we're going to get to this in a minute anyhow. The first year of Koresh, just as Yirmiyahu had predicted. Now, what did Yirmiyahu predict? Yirmiyahu predicted that the Babylonians would be in power for 70 years. I want to clarify that because it's going to be critical for the next part of this year. Yirmiyahu's original prophecy of 70 years, which everyone's heard of, I think we talked about this before, was not that there would be destruction for 70 years of the temple, nor did he say that the people would be in exile for 70 years. When Yirmiyahu first made his prophecy in the fourth year of Yehoiakim, he was telling the people to accept Babylonian sovereignty And your punishment for not listening to God is the Babylonians are going to take over your country. And Yirmiyahu gave them the choice, either accept Babylonian sovereignty. And if you do that, you can stay in your land and don't have to go into exile and keep your temple. If you rebel against the Babylonians and don't accept that decree of God, then the Babylonians are going to come and take over your city and exile you, and you won't be able to stay in your land. Now, they don't listen. Nebuchadnezzar comes during the reign of Jehoiakim, and then right after Jehoiakim takes over, the Jews rebel, and they fight them. And then, once Zedekiah is king, in the middle of Zedekiah's reign, when they rebel again, and there's already a group of people in exile, Yirmiyahu tells the people in exile, he sends this letter and tells the people, after these 7 years of Babylonian rule are over, I'll remember to bring you back to the land, but you have to want to come back. You have to look for me, and then I'll be there for you. We talked about this earlier in the course, in our first classes. But what's important for our shir today is that, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the first Persian king is Koresh, and when Koresh becomes king, Yirmiyahu's 7 years are over. It was Yirmiyahu's prediction of 7 years of Babylonian rule. And after Babylon rule is over, there'll be an opportunity to return. That finishes with the first year of Koresh. Now, let's go back to our beginning up here and go back up. Okay, now, so we did Ezra chapter 1. In Ezra chapter 4, what did we talk about? We spent a lot of time in this before. They returned under Koresh, and we talked about the first intifada in chapter 4. Just a quick review. We get back where we were before. Where are we? We saw Haggai, and we didn't want that there. I'm sorry. Back up to just a quick review because we need these psukim inside. In chapter 4 in the book of Ezra, I'll need to open up a Tanakh. If you have a Tanakh with you, you can do the same. We'll open up the book of Ezra in chapter 4. Remember, when they return, they start building. And in chapter 4, the enemies of Yehuda and Binyamin, the local population that wasn't Jewish, hear that they're returning. They want to join in the project. And Zerubbabel gets into a fight with them. And therefore, Vayi Am Aretz, Mrapim Midam Yehuda, the local population was weakening the hands of the people of Yehuda, scaring them from building. And here's the most important pasuk for today. V'stachrim alem yotzim lafer satam. They hired lobbyists to write bad letters and tattletale on the Jews and stop the building from the time of Koresh all the way to the reign of Daryavash. So from Koresh to Daryavash, there's a building freeze. And then here we have the first mention of Achashverosh in Tanakh. U'machut Achashverosh b'tchat machuto katvu sidnau yoshvei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. A very vague pasuk, very unclear. Is this Achashverosh? Is that the gap between Koresh and Daryavash? In other words, we know there's a building freeze between Koresh and Daryavash. That's for sure. And it seems that there's a king in between, because it's not Koresh and Daryavash, but from Koresh till Daryavash. So I could easily understand there's a king in between. And it could be this verse is saying, what happened in between? Not only was there a hate letter during the time of Koresh, but also during the reign of Achashverosh, there was a hate letter against the Jews, and explains why there was a building freeze. And then in the second year of Daryavash, that's when in the book of Haggai, we start building again. And in chapter 7 already, we have, it's already Aramaic, we have details of the letters going back and forth where the local population is getting them to stop the building. Who this king is, if we have time, we'll talk about later on. Now, that's the first mention of Achashverosh outside Megillat Esther in this context among the Persian kings. So let's go back now to what we talked about earlier, and here we go. So we had the book of Ezra, and we had from year 2, we had the gap between Koresh to Achashverosh, from Koresh to Daryavash, and with the possibility that Achashverosh might be the king in between, based on that unclear pasuk in Pasuk Zion. Now we know in chapter 6 in Ezra, we saw that in the 6th year of Daryavash, they finished building the temple, and that we spent a lot of time on. In chapter 7 of Ezra, Ezra makes Aliyah and finds intermarriage, etc. And we talked about we'll go now to what we're going to review, the intentional gaps in the book of Ezra. Meaning, the first gap we discussed was from Koresh to Daryavash, Remember, the gap one was between Koresh and Daryavish, the pasuk we just read. And therefore, according to Seder Olam, as we're going to see, that gap is going to be Achashverosh of Megillat Esther. We have to see if it fits. And then we had year two to year six of Daryavish when they build the temple. And then the next gap between chapter 6 and 7 of the book of Ezra, which was between year 6 of Daryavish, year 7 of Artaxasta, we had another gap between Daryavish and Artaxasta. And Seder Olam, remember, claims that Daryavish is Artaxasta and there is no gap, and therefore Achashverosh can't be there. We're going to see in our shir today, if I look at outside history, Achashverosh could easily be in that gap. That's what we're going to see now. Now, how are we going to determine that? If I only have Tanakh and Seder Olam, then what are the orders of the Persian kings, as we'll see? It's Koresh, and then Achashverosh, and then Daryavish. And that during that building freeze, between the broke ground and the temple, until the temple finally got off the ground, that's when Megillat Esther took place. We have to see if it fits with outside history. If I look at outside history, it'll be a little more confusing. So let's review, let's close Tanakh for a minute, and just open up any encyclopedia or any source, outside historical source. These are the dates you'll find in every history book. And we have 586 was the destruction of the temple with Nebuchadnezzar, etc. 538, maybe 537, maybe 539, but give or take a year or two, is when Cyrus takes over and defeats the Babylonians. And that's the year of the Cyrus decree. Cyrus is Koresh. The next king is called Cambyses. He's never mentioned in Tanakh. He might be referred to as that Artaxasta that we read about in chapters 4 to 6 in Ezra, but we'll leave that alone for now. There's a king named Darius in 522, a king named Xerxes in 486, and a king named Artaxerxes in 465. Now, if I want to match them up with names in the Bible, which are the most similar? So the most similar to Cyrus would be Koresh. The most similar to Darius would be Daryavish. And the most similar to Xerxes would be Achashverosh. I'll explain why in a minute. And the Artaxerxes would be Artaxasta. Now, you might remember when you have Aramaic, you just take off the Aleph. You add an Aleph to an Aramaic word and make it Hebrew. If I take off the Aleph, and then, second, and just read what's left, I have Chashrash. See the words? Chashrash, which might be Xerxes. So that's what the linguistic people say. That's probably the best match, that Xerxes, of all the names, matches Achashverosh the best. If that's true, then when does Megillat Esther happen? Megillat Esther is happening after the temple is built. So if I don't follow Chazal and don't follow Seder Olam and just have the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, and I just have Haggai and Zechariah, etc., and I look and I match the books in Tanakh with the outside sources, then the outside sources in Tanakh match perfectly. Koresh, Ben, Osiris, we don't know who matches Cambyses, but we know there's a gap in between. Daryavish is Darius, and Achashverosh is Xerxes, and Artaxasta is Artaxerxes. So therefore, gap two is Achashverosh. And we'll see in a minute why he needs to fit there. Why? We know in Megillat Esther that the story, the main story of the decree going out, that the Jews are going to be killed, and when they're saved, that all takes place in year 12 of Achashverosh. It's from chapter 3 to the end of the Megillah is year 12 of Achashverosh. And then at the end of the year, remember Nisan, at the beginning of the year, he does a lottery. And Adar that year is when the story takes place, when the miracle, when the salvation takes place. And the next year, there's another letter going out. That's already year 13. And therefore, there's at least 14 years of Achashverosh's reign in Megillat Esther. If I match those 14 years with outside history, and if I want to say that Cambyses is the king, is Achashverosh, then there's not enough room because he's only reigned for 8 years and I need 14 years of Achashverosh. And all these dates are pretty much, again, I'm not going to go and question the dates. Almost 99% of all historians accept these dates. You know, that's a topic by itself, but assuming these dates are correct, there's no way that the story of Achashverosh could be here because I don't have 14 years. On the other hand, if Xerxes is the king, then Xerxes reigns for some, how many years? Some 30 years, so 20. From 46 to 465 is over 21 years. So there's plenty of room for the 14 years of Megillat Esther to take place during the reign of Xerxes. So for all those reasons, it makes sense that Ahasuerus, historically, is the king between Darius and Artaxerxes, and basically smack in that gap. And this is the approach we're going to follow in our share. I'm going to read the Megillah, assuming what? I'm going to read the Megillah assuming that the story takes place between Darius and Artaxerxes, or basically exactly in gap two, which means after the temple was built, before Ezra returns. And what we call that dark time period that we had to skip in the book of Ezra, we don't know what happened. All we know is that there were great hopes once the temple was built to be what we call the beginning of our redemption. Rishit Simchat Gulateinu. Haggai had great hopes. Zechariah had great hopes. And things were supposed to be great. But some 30 years later, when Ezra makes Aliyah, he finds mass intermarriage and the city's dilapidated in ruins, and something must have gone wrong. And then during that time period where Am Yisrael doesn't answer the call is when Megillat Esther takes place. Now, before I go into that, we're going to check what happens with Seder Olam, how Seder Olam deals with it. And remember, Seder Olam doesn't, okay, I'm going to review Seder Olam, and we'll take care of that in a minute. What's that? The fellow who received the Kelim doesn't have a Jewish name. Who's this guy? First of all, you can have a Shesh Batzar. Could be, we see in the book of Daniel that the Jewish leaders have Jewish names and Persian names. We see that in the book of Daniel quite often. And we'll talk about Jewish people with Babylonian names, but it only makes a lot of sense that once Am Yisrael is living in a foreign land, the Jewish people have foreign names. I can bring lots of example from even religious Jews in America who names are from the New Testament. Now, let's follow Seder Olam. I'm going to review Seder Olam real quickly. If I follow Seder Olam, I'm going to review the conclusions and then just sew it inside again. Seder Olam, Koresh has to be the first Persian king. In Seder Olam, Daryavesh is Artaxerxes, and he's the last Persian king, which means the only place I could possibly put Koresh, I'm sorry, the only place I could possibly put Ahasuerus is between Koresh and Daryavesh. I'll make that perfectly clear in a minute because we have to review Seder Olam. But what I'm trying to, let me go back to here's what we did in Seder Olam. When we calculated the years of the Exodus, remember we wanted to get to the year 1000? We wanted the Greek year to begin 1000 from the Exodus. Remember what we did? We had a pasuk. It was from Yitzhak Mitzrayim, from the Exodus until they built the first temple, was 480. The 410 years of the first temple period. And then we had 7 years in the book of Zechariah. We're going to return to that in a minute, which is from the time the first temple was destroyed until the second year of Daryavesh. And from the second year of Daryavesh till the end of Tanakh is the 34 years that remained. And then 6 years later, Alexander the Great comes. So basically, if I follow Seder Olam, and that was necessary to turn the Jewish year, to turn the Greek year into a Jewish year, so that Minyan Shoah began 1,000 years after the Exodus, then the entire Persian time period is very limited. And from the time the temple was built in year two of Daryavesh, who is Artaxerxes, we only have 34 years. And that means, and because Darius is Artaxerxes and he's the last Persian king, and 6 years later, Alexander the Great comes, the story of Megillat Esther must have happened before Darius, but after Koresh. So it's got to be between those 70 years after the temple was destroyed, but before the temple was rebuilt. Now we're going to calculate, but now we'll do the calculations that Seder Olam does. Now remember, Seder Olam does not have these dates. Seder Olam doesn't deal with them, doesn't relate to them, and these don't match Seder Olam. But we explained that when we did that share earlier. Now, the outside history doesn't match. I want to show you the logic of Seder Olam, what happened. And we'll see so many midrashim that we're all familiar with are based on what Seder Olam did. Now, again, if I follow Seder Olam, there's only one possibility where Ahasuerus could fit, because there's only three Persian kings. The first Persian king is Koresh. He has to be the first one. Daryavesh is Artaxerxes, has to be the last one. Ahasuerus must be the middle one. But the question is, can he fit? So to do that, we have to take what's called two sets of 70 years. We have a second. I hope I have this thing here. Okay. We're going to have two sets of 70 years from two different Nevi'im. Let me take my, stop my screen share for a minute. What confuses many people, and this I want to clarify before we get into the details of it, everyone, just almost everyone, at least everyone in our class, has heard of the 70 years of exile between the first temple period and the second temple period. The popular understanding is it's 7 years of exile or 7 years of destruction, and they sort of conflate the two. When you look carefully, there's two different sets of 70 years. One is a prediction by Yirmiyahu. The other is a statement of fact by the Nevi Zechariah. I want to begin with what we saw in Zechariah, because that's our anchor. And that's what we had in Seder Olam. And then we'll go back and see Yirmiyahu. If I go back to the book of Zechariah, Zechariah begins in the second year of Dariavesh. Here we are. Where's good old Zechariah? Here's Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 1. It's the eighth month in the year, second year of Dariavesh. King Darius, year 2. He has his nevuah. And this one takes place on the 24th day of the 11th month, in the second year of Dariavesh. He has a vision and he sees these horses, red horses, without going into the details. It's interesting, though, that these horses are standing between hadassim. Some people want to say that maybe Esther's name might relate to these hadassim, but it might be, but I'm not sure how. That's not critical for following our approach. He has a vision, and he wants to understand what's the meaning of the vision. What does the malach answer? Vayan malach Hashem vayomar, Hashem tzvot. Ad matay ata lo terachem et Yerushalayim v'tarei Yehuda asher z'amta zeh 70 shana. In year 2 of Dariavesh, there's this angel of God or messenger of God in Zechariah's dream who's checking out Jerusalem, what's going on. They just broke ground on the temple. Remember, in the month of Kislev, in the ninth month of the second year of Dariavesh, they just broken ground. They're just getting started. They're praying that this building project will get off the ground because 18 years ago, we'll see, in the time of Koresh, it didn't get off the ground. They're starting up again, and they're hoping maybe this time God will have mercy on them, and this time the temple will finally get off the ground. And therefore, they're asking, there's a prayer here to God, maybe will you now have mercy on Jerusalem? Your anger has been against it for the last 70 years, which implies that the temple has been destroyed for 70 years. And the Malach gives him a good answer and says, don't worry, I'm zealous now to fix up Yerushalayim. And therefore, the famous line, what does God say? In Pasuk Tet Zayin, Nachin Komar Hashem, Shafti Yerushalayim Barachamim Biti Ibaneva. We quote this in Shmoneh Esrei, Yerushalayim Yecha Barachamim Teshuv, is based on this Pasuk. We're asking God to return Yerushalayim like he promised. God saying, I'm bringing my Shekhinah back to Yerushalayim in mercy. Biti Ibaneva, the house will be rebuilt, God says, and we'll start all the building projects. And it'll be, what do you call it? The city will expand and things will be great. And once again, God will have mercy and choose again Jerusalem to be our capital city and have his temple there. Now, based on that verse, we know that it's 70 years from the time of the destruction until the time of, from the time of the first temple being destroyed until they break ground on the second temple in year 2 of Dariavesh. Now, if I translate that into years in Tanakh, that's going to be 70 years of from the 11th year of Tzidkiyahu, we'll see this soon, to the second year of Dariavesh. If I talk about Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyahu had a different set of 70 years. Yirmiyahu in chapter 25, we saw all this before. Where's Yirmiyahu? In chapter 25 of Yirmiyahu, just to review the first line, this is what happens in the fourth year. In the fourth year of King Jehoiakim, which is the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel. Why is there a double date in the beginning of this chapter? Because he gives all this warning and he tells him, because you haven't been listening to me for the last 23 years, and I'm going to come and bring Nebuchadnezzar, Yirmiyahu says, and bring him on this land. And then he says as follows, Pasuk Yud Aleph, on the whole Middle East, God's saying, and through Yirmiyahu, that Babel is going to be sovereign over the Middle East for the next 70 years. And then, when those 7 years are over, I'm going to punish Melech Bavel for all the things he did wrong, and they'll be punished, they'll be taken over by somebody else. Therefore, Yirmiyahu's 70 years begin in the fourth year of Yehoiakim, and they end with the first year of Koresh. I hope that's clear. Let me just review that real fast. I have two sets of 7 years that overlap, but they're not identical. There's 70 years of Babylonian rule that begin in year four of Yehoiakim and end in the first year of Koresh. I have 7 years of destruction, which begins in the 11th year of Tzidkiyahu and ends in the second year of Koresh. Now I need to figure out what's the overlap between those years, but it's really easy to calculate. All you need to do, we have a little table here that clarifies it, but again, Yirmiyahu's 70 years, we just read, from year four of Yehoiakim to year one of Koresh, Zechariah's are from year 11 of Tzidkiyahu to year two of Daryavish. Now, let's go to good old Tanakh and see how they overlap. So look at this little table here. On the left side, let me get a little marker here. Here we go. On this side over here, these are the years of Babylonian rule. In other words, this is chapter 25 in Yirmiyahu. The first year of Babylonian rule is when Nebuchadnezzar reigns, which is the fourth year of Jehoiakim. The 70th year of Babylonian rule is the Cyrus Declaration, the first year of Koresh. That's Ezra chapter 1. What happens in between? Now we just need the book of Malachim. We know that Yehoiakim reigned for 11 years. His son Yehoiakim took over for 3 months and then surrendered and went into exile. So Galut Yehoiakim, also known as Galut Yechoniah, happens in the 11th year of Yehoiakim, or basically 7 years after Nebuchadnezzar comes into reign. But the temple is not destroyed yet. Instead, the king of Babel appoints a vassal king, Tzidkiyahu, who reigns for 11 years. And even though Nebuchadnezzar took over the city in the 11th year of Yehoiakim, the temple remains standing for another 11 years. In the middle of Tzidkiyahu's reign, in the fifth year of his reign, he decides to rebel against the Babylonians. They're successful for a couple of years. In the ninth year of Tzidkiyahu, on the 10th of Tebet, the Babylonians return and put a siege on the city. In the 11th year of Tzidkiyahu, as we all know, on Tisha B'Av or on the 10th of Av or the 7th of Av, the temple was destroyed by the Babylonians by Nebuzaradan. And that's year 18 into the 7 years of Babylonian rule. Now, but that year is the first year, right? That year of 11th of Tzidkiyahu is the first year of the 70 years of Zechariah. So how do you get to Zechariah 70 years? What do we have? We have the Cyrus Declaration in year 70. And then, because there's 18 years from the beginning of Yirmiyahu, 7 years until the beginning, there's an 18-year overlap from the time Yirmiyahu 7 years begin until Zechariah 7 years begin. And there's 18 years in the beginning, there's 18 years in the end. And therefore, from the first year of Cyrus, from the first Persian king, the first year of Koresh, there's 18 years until the second year of Daryavash. Okay? Now, what did Chazal do? Within these 18 years, I need to fit all the events of Megillat Esther. Let me make that clear again. I have 18 years here between this and this, between these two events, between the Cyrus Declaration and year two of Daryavash when they break ground on the temple. I can only have 18 years by definition if I follow Tanakh, if I only have Tanakh. I have at least 14 years of Achashverosh. Can it fit? Well, we'll see it's going to fit perfect. Why? Tanakh never tells us how many years Cyrus was king for. Outside history tells us he reigned for another 9 years. But Tanakh doesn't have that. On the other hand, if you open up your Tanakh in the book of Daniel, we're going to find that Daniel has a vision. Pretty sure it's chapter 10 or 11. We'll find it in a minute. Daniel is over here. We go. We'll try with chapter 10, and then we'll switch. Yeah, chapter 10. Bishnat shalosh l'korash melech paras, dabar nigla l'Daniel. Okay. Daniel has a vision in the third year of Koresh. It doesn't say that Koresh died that year, but I know from chapter 10 of Daniel, and this is chronologically the last event in Daniel. It's not the last chapter, but the last event in historical order. We know from here that Koresh was king for at least 3 years, because Daniel had a vision in the third year of Koresh. Did he live longer? We don't know. But he was alive at least 3 years. So I have at least 3 years of Koresh, okay? And we know Haggai builds the temple in the second year of Dayavish. So let's go back and see what we're left with. Actually, it's real easy. There's at least 3 years of Koresh. So what's Sedra Olam say? Koresh was king for 3 years and that's it. And then Achashverosh reigns in the third year of Koresh. Now, in the second year of Dayavish, already they're building the temple, which means Darius became king in year 87, which leaves exactly 14 years for Achashverosh. Understand? From 73 to 87, there's only 14 years that Achashverosh can fit in. And it's almost like a perfect match. And basically, what conclusion does Seder Olam reach? That the 14 years that we find in the book of Megillat Esther is exactly the gap between Koresh and Daryavish. Koresh had to be king for these 3 years. So what happened? That's the year he died. And then the next year, Achashverosh takes over. He's the king in between. He's king for 14 years. The year that Megillat Esther ends, Achashverosh suddenly dies. And his son Darius takes over. And the next year, we're already building the second temple. So, what did we gain by that? There's a famous medrash, I'm sure you all heard. Why is it that Darius allows the Jews to build the temple? Well, if Darius is the king after Achashverosh, Darius is the son of Achashverosh, and Esther is his mommy. And therefore, but if you do the calculation, he couldn't have been more than 6 or 7 years old at the time. And therefore, why is Dayavish allow the Jews to build the temple? Because he's Esther's son, and he's really not running the country. He's only 6 years old. Who's really running the country? Mordechai and Esther. And then, if we do this, every single year is accounted for. We have the 3 years of Koresh. Fits perfect with the book of Daniel. We have the 14 years of Achashverosh in between. Fits perfect with the book of Esther. And then we have the second year of Daryavish. And then because there's no gap between the sixth year of Daryavish and the seventh year of Artaxerxes, because they're the same king, then every single year is accounted for in Seder Olam. And that's, remember, we go back to what we saw before. Let's go back to our mouse and clear this. That was exactly the 70 years of... That was exactly, we put everything in these 70 years, and that's how we got to the year 1000. So if I want to just summarize my conclusion, if I want to understand what Chazal did with Megillat Esther, it's nice and simple in Seder Olam. There's nowhere else to put Achashverosh other than between Koresh and Dayavish. I can't put it anywhere else. And it exactly fits. He squeezes right in and there's nothing else. Once I have that, now we go back to the Megillah and look at all the different events. What do we find? Well, we know if I go through the events of Megillat Esther, Megillat Esther begins in year 3. Remember, B'shat Shlosh Shemacho, he makes a Mishteh. What's happening in year 3 of King Achashverosh? Let's see. If he becomes king in year 73, in year 76 is a big party. Right. Now, year 76 is what? Is 76 years since Nebuchadnezzar's reign, but it's 69 years. Where are we? Okay. It's 69 years from when? From Galut Yehoyachin. Now, if you want to, right, that's a big party. Got it? From year 7 to 76. It's 69 years from the first wave of exile of Yehoyachin. So what do the rabbis say in Seder Olam? Why is Achashverosh making a party? Because he miscalculated Yirmiyahu's 70 years. He thought 70 years has passed, but it was only 69. He was off by a year. You know, he made a mistake in his math. But he thought Yirmiyahu's 7 years are over. And they're so happy the Jews didn't return, and there's no return to the temple. And he takes out the Kedim of the Beit HaMikdash, and they're celebrating the fact that Jews have not rebuilt the temple. I'm sure you're familiar with that Midrash. Is that Pshat in the Megillah of Persian history? Of course not. But what are the rabbis doing? Everywhere possible in the Midrash, they're bringing the Beit HaMikdash into the story. Now, okay, I have only a couple of minutes left, so let me finish this up, and then I'll take questions. But the two, let me go over the two or three key points that everyone learned when you learn classic Jewish history and Seder Olam when you study Megillat Esther. When you study Megillat Esther, everyone puts Achashverosh after Koresh. And hence, Achashverosh is the father of Daryavesh, of Darius, who allows the Jews to rebuild the temple. And the reason for the party is because Yirmiyahu's 7 years are over. The Beis HaMikdash isn't rebuilt. And the kelim at the Beit HaMikdash, the kelim at the party, the kelim at the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the question is, when the rabbis say those things, are they telling you what they think is historically true? Are they doing the same thing that the Megillah is doing? Because if I look at real history and outside history, what do I know? If I look at the real history, let's go here. Where's our real history? I'm sorry. You were up here. If I look at the real history, Achashverosh is where, exactly in the gap between Daryavesh and Achashverosh. From a prophetic point of view, after the sixth year of Daryavesh, the temple is built. This was the big gap we talked about between the sixth year of Daryavesh and the seventh year of Artaxerxes, the big gap in the book of Ezra. It's all hush. We don't know what happened then. But if I follow outside history, how many years passed by? From here till here, from 518 till 465. Some 45th years passed by, and nothing happened. If you remember what we read in Zechariah, which we'll have to see next week. In Zechariah, in the fourth year, when the people ask, do we continue fasting? God says, I'm returning my people. The Shekhinah is going to return. Zechariah talked about the Shekhinah returning. Fast days turning into holidays. No need to fast anymore and things like that. Everyone was hoping that this would be the final redemption, the Jews would return, and the temple would be rebuilt, and things would be great. If the story of Megillat Esther is happening in the very immediately after the reign of Darius, some 15, 20 years after the temple was built already, and Amisar didn't answer the call, then I might have a reason why God's angry with his people. You know what it would be like? Assuming that God wants, if I follow the biggest theme of Tanakh, and especially following Yirmiyahu's hope. When Yirmiyahu's 7 years are over, Am Yisrael has a chance to return to its land, rebuild the temple, and become God's people again. If they don't answer that call, wouldn't God be really upset? God gives with the Cyrus declaration, we have this great opportunity to return to become God's people. We know that only a small portion of the people return. Most of the people are still in the Persian Empire. If you were God, wouldn't you be upset? Would there be any reason to keep just your connection to your people? And I want to read two psukim or three in Megillat Esther that might be alluding to that. Because remember, we don't have God's name, but the biggest word in Megillah is the word Melech, isn't it? Every column begins with the word Melech. And there's a question whether who's the Melech of Achashverosh, who's the king of the book. And if you remember the first line that... Sorry, not this one. If you remember the first time that Haman himself is quoted, I keep on getting the wrong share. The first time that we quote Haman is the beginning of chapter 3. Here we go here. What does Haman say? I'm sorry. Remember, there's one nation. I will get to this one in a minute. Remember, Haman says there's a nation. Again, wrong share. I'll get it straight one day. Here we go. We're going to open the Tanakh. Here we are. Book of Esther in chapter 3. And I think verse 8 in chapter 3. The opening words of Haman to Esther. Vayomer Haman. I mean to Achashverosh. Yeshno am echad v'fazan farad ben amim. There's a nation scattered among the different nations in the entire Persian Empire. But that tam should not be called. Their laws are different. They're not following the laws of their king, and it's not worth for the king to keep them around. Now, of course, Haman's referring to Achashverosh, and the Jews not following Achashverosh. But could this be alluding to the fact that the king is God, and the Jewish people aren't following their God? If I want to go back a story, you know what it'd be like? You can compare this to the following story. Let's say there's a king, a great king, who is celebrating how great he is. He thinks he's like the real king of all kings. He's making a big party to celebrate his his coronation or how great he is. And let's say he's married to a trophy wife. She used to be a model, but she, what do you call it? She was like the prettiest, super pretty. And he calls his wife to come to the inauguration ball. And imagine if she says, you know what, I don't want to come because I don't like your pot. Like, if she refused to come, wouldn't the king be really angry? That was, he wants to show off his trophy wife to everyone around, and she doesn't want to show. Now, isn't that really similar to the first story of Megillat Esther? Which is a really, that's a, one of the big questions. What's that story doing in the beginning of the Megillah? Remember, first we talked about this party in Shoshana Bira and the Kidim Kidim Shonim. Now, everyone knows that the king called for Vashti to come, and Vashti doesn't come. Remember this guy, Memuchan? Okay. What does Memuchan say about Vashti? V'yomer Memuchan lifnei melech basarim. Lo ala melech levado avta Vashti amaka. Vashti's sin, not coming to show her beauty to all the nations, to honor Ahasuerus. Remember, if the king calling his wife to show her beauty, to make himself look great among the nations, if we take the analogy to God, who wants his glory to be known, if he chose the Jewish people to sanctify God among the nations, to show God's beauty, and that's why God wants his temple and his people back in his land, then this would be a terrible precedent. Okay? This was not only a transgression against the king, this is a transgression against everyone, all civilization. Because what will happen? Because word will get out that what? That everyone, they take it really too far, that can believe it, that women might start embarrassing their husbands in public. Can imagine what kind of disaster that would be. And therefore, he sends the strangest edict afterwards because of what Vashti did. He sends for him to all the king, all the lands of the, all the states in the kingdom. Okay? They call Adam Kush and every nation based on their thing. Every nation has to be in its land, in its home, and speak its own language. Now, that's the question. Is this just part of the story? Or is this, if I use the analogy back to Animal Farm, is the Megillah up to something else? Now, if I want to make my assumption that the author of Megillat Esther is assuming his reader knows that the Jewish people did not answer their call and didn't return, the question is the way the story is being told, is it being told in a way so that the reader, oh my gosh, maybe it's me. I'll give you a really bad example. Remember King David did that terrible sin with Bathsheba? So Natan HaNavi doesn't come and tell King David, oh, you did a terrible thing. What's he do? He makes up a story. Remember about the guy who steals the poor man's lamb. You know, the rich guy was there. And then only after the story, that's you. And sometimes through an analogy, sometimes when you give Musar in an indirect way, sometimes it's much more powerful. Again, we'll never know for sure if that's true, or it could be that's just what happened. But my point is, if I take into consideration the time period, the theme not just of Chumash, the theme of the entire Tanakh, especially the theme that we've been discussing for our 14, 15 classes so far, of what I call from Cyrus to, from King Cyrus to Lord Balfour. If I'm assuming that God wants his people to return to their land, and they don't, and that's a very good reason for God to be upset, the question is, do I have a reason why God is upset with his people? And not only does the Megillah tell us about how God saves his people, it might be also alluding to the fact of why God almost destroyed his people. Then the question is going to come up, if we deserve being destroyed, why don't we get destroyed? So that would do in our next year, when we talk about Shira Tazino, remember the name Esther Banochi, what's called the idea of Hester Panim. And what I'm going to do in next year, we're going to take a whole bunch of, if you download the source sheet, you'll see them, lots of sources from Scharia. We're going to show you numerous places in the Megillah that might be alluding to all the things we saw in the book of Ezra, in the book of Scharia, in the book of Haggai, etc., of what's going on. Now, this is something, once something's written, not explicit, but only implicit, there's no way I can prove it only through circumstantial evidence. And that's the question, whether the authors were writing something satirical. Now, we're not questioning the authenticity of the story. Whether the story happened or not, it's not really important. Something must have happened. The question is how the story is being written. Because the story is written in a fairy tale style. I hardly doubt that every single detail is a very, what do you call it, exact historical recording of the events. But the author is writing it to give a message to his people. And the question is the book of Esther giving Musar to the Jewish people for not returning to rebuild the temple? And then everyone would decide on their own. But that's like the big argument in modern day scholarship also. Aaron Collar has given classes here before, right? So Aaron Collar is the...
Although not on Purim. He hasn't taught on Purim, but yes.
Yeah. He champions the idea that it's only about the Jews in exile. It's got nothing to do with Israel and Jerusalem. And Yoni Grossman has a whole book on...
Avi Walfish gave a talk a number of years ago, I think, for Torah Motion, where he took the, you know, it's a huge critique on the Jewish community in the exile. It carries over into the Mishnah, the first Mishnah, the second Megillah, the 5 days to read the Megillah, whatever. He had a whole shiur on that. That's the other side. But okay, you go on.
Okay, so that was the thing. Let me look at the chat real fast. That's too big this time. One second. Chat is here. Seder Olam is Midrashic for sure. Yeah, we talked Seder Olam, and we said that Seder Olam is Midrashic. And the question is, when Seder Olam gives a history, are they telling you what they thought was history, or they know that's not real history, but it's part of Seder Olam, but they're embellishing the history? But once I need to get to year 1000, it works out great with Megillat Esther. Later, why Jewish history and why like rabbinic tradition has accepted Seder Olam as real history? Then hopefully we'll have time to talk about in the next class. I'm not sure whether Persians, by the way, the Persians and the Jews got along great together, only like recently with the extremists taking over. But before Khomeini took over, Israel and Persia got along great with each other. They were like buddy buddies. We have a long history getting, and during Babylonian times, you know, during the time of the Gaonim, Jews in Babylonia were, thrived under Persian rule. So, Hypestes Darius? The actual Darius's real father was somebody else for sure. Definitely wasn't Achashverosh. Even in outside history, it's not Achashverosh. He's coming from a totally different lineage. Again, what I'm trying to say is the classic Seder Olam history doesn't fit with Tanakh, and it doesn't fit with outside history at all. But when you read it, when you teach it simplistically, now the problem with it, it works so perfectly. You follow? The years just match up exactly. They just squeeze in perfectly, and it matches. I have a reason for the party. It's called Sibalam Siba, and I have a reason for why Darius allows the Jews to build the temple, and it fits so nicely. You know, why ruin it? It's got such a nice, simple explanation. Plus, you get to the Greek year being the Jewish year of 1,000 years, and it just became so accepted. We're working backwards. Once I accept Seder Olam, remember I told you the Jewish state 5781 is built on Seder Olam? So once I write that date on every Jewish document, right, on Aksuba and everything, and on Tum, that, then all the Midrashim that fit Seder Olam become Jewish history. Because if I say Achashverosh is later on, then there goes 5781. So almost by default, once I accept the years 5781, I have to accept Seder Olam is historically true. And if Seder Olam is historically true, then Seder Olam's explanation of Megillat Esther becomes Jewish history. And that's in all the Jewish history books that's how it's written. So almost every R scroll Jewish history book, even in the Talmud, it goes that way. Everyone accepts this as given history. I'm trying to explain how it came about that it became history, even though it was only Midrashic interpretation. But because the Midrashic interpretation is so good and it fits so nicely, it just got accepted widely. And until we started getting to archaeology and outside history and documents and study and things like that, then we can uncover the deeper meaning of the book. Okay. Alrighty. So.
Thank you.
I think next week's the fun part, where I go through the Megillah and show you. We'll see Zecharia coming through the woodwork. I think it's called. We'll see a lot of psukim that if this theory is not true, the psukim simply don't make sense. If the theory is true, then psukim make a lot of sense.
Okay, people commenting a little on your history thing, I think we can pick up on that next week. Probably we have a different view of history today. And for sure, I'm sure many of these people thought it was real history. We may know it's Midrashic history, but that doesn't mean that people saying it thought that. They may have thought it was real history.
Yeah, but why wouldn't they think that? Because they don't have all the other sources.
Right. Today, it's a little bit different. Yeah, it's a big topic. This
if you grow up and the only source you have is Seder Olam, my point when I did the Seder Olam share was that Seder Olam knew the real history, but made up the Midrashic history for its thematic purpose, you know, to make the Jewish year, the Greek year, Jewish year. Therefore, it uses Midrashic interpretation to fit, make sure the years fit. But because it works so nicely, and because later on that became the accepted Jewish year, then all those Midrashim de facto became Jewish history because people weren't aware of the real history. And then that became the real, it makes sense what happened. How many people in medieval times had Josephus and they had all the Babylonian the Greek histories and the Babylonian histories and the Persian histories and the archaeology and the astronomical data that wasn't available with anybody. So why wouldn't you take Seder Olam literally? It works so nice. It's just too good to be true.
Rabbi, have we spoken about? I forget if we spoke about Rabbi Schwab's article about this whole thing with the destruction of the temple. That. You know, how when you've alluded to it, how Chazal purposely,
that they make him take it back, that they purposely hid the year so when Mashiach comes, we'll be caught by surprise.
Right. But Rabbi Schwab said now that it's been revealed that what the true history is, we have to teach the true history. We can no longer teach as history, quote unquote, the Midrashic history, as you like to put it. So that's, he wrote an article many years ago. I don't know where to have the link it is offhand, but Rabbi Schwab, the head of the Boris community in Washington Heights, about his sort of understanding of history.
That's already an educational question about what you teach people and how you teach it. That's an educational dilemma. You bring this up when you teach this to kids, because all day come up, the rabbis are wrong. If the rabbi is wrong about history, they're wrong about halacha, and I can pick and choose.
Right. So we've discussed this already a few times. But yes, but it's important. That's, I think, why he was pointing it out. There was a reason for Chazal to do it. But to continue with that in the light of, you know, archaeology and historical evidence would be a huge mistake. I think he was giving an educational idea. Anyway. Okay. Thank you very much. We look forward to next week.